As time passed, I seldom saw Joshua except at mealtimes and before we went to sleep. Nearly all my time was taken up with my studies and helping the girls maintain the fortress, while nearly all of Joshua's time was spent with Balthazar, which would eventually become a problem.
"This is not good, Biff," Joy said in Chinese.
I learned to speak her language well enough that she seldom spoke Greek or Latin anymore.
"Balthazar is getting too close with Joshua. He seldom sends for one of us to join him in his bed now."
"You're not implying that Joshua and Balthazar are, playing shepherd, are you? Because I know that's not true. Joshua isn't allowed." Of course, the angel had said he couldn't know a woman. He hadn't said anything about a creepy old African wizard.
"Oh, I don't care if they're buggering the eyeballs out," said Joy. "Balthazar mustn't fall in love. Why do you think that there are 8 of us?"
"I thought it was a matter of budget," I said.
"You haven't noticed that one of us will never spend 2 nights in a row with Balthazar, or that we don't speak with him beyond what is required for our duties and lessons?"
I had noticed, but it had never occurred to me that there was something out of the ordinary. We hadn't gotten to the chapter on wizard concubine behavior in the book yet.
"So?" "So I think he is falling in love with Joshua. That is not good."
"Well, I'm with you on that one. I wasn't happy the last time someone fell in love with him, but why does it matter here?"
"I can't tell you, but there has been more commotion coming from the House of Doom," said Joy. "You have to help me. If I'm right, we have to stop Balthazar. We'll observe them tomorrow while we adjust the flow of chi in the library."
"No, Joy, not the library chi. The stuff in the library is too heavy. I hate library chi." "Chi, or ki, the breath of the dragon, the eternal energy that flows through all things, in balance, as it should be, it was half yin, half yang, half light, half dark, half male, half female. The chi in the library was always getting fucked up, while the chi in the rooms with just cushions, or with lightweight furniture, seemed well-adjusted and balanced. I don't know why, but I suspected it had a lot to do with Joy's need to make me move heavy things. The next morning, Joy and I went to the library to spy on Joshua and Balthazar while we redirected the library's chi. Joy carried a complex brass instrument she called a chi clock, which was supposed to be able to detect the flow of chi. The magus was noticeably irritated as soon as we entered the room.
"Must this be done now?"
Joy bowed.
"Very sorry, master, but this is an emergency."
She turned and barked commands at me like a Roman centurion.
"Move that table over there! Can't you see that it rests on the tiger's testicles? Then point those chairs so they face the doorway. They lie on the dragon's navel. Well, lucky someone hasn't broken a leg."
"Yeah, lucky," I said, straining to move the huge carved table, wishing that Joy had recruited a couple of the other girls to help. I'd been studying feng shui for more than 3 years now, and I still couldn't detect the least bit of chi coming or going. Joshua had reconciled the elusive energy by saying that it was just an oriental way to express God all around us and in all things. That may have helped him toward some sort of spiritual understanding, but it was about as effective as trained sheep when it came to arranging furniture.
"Can I help?"
Joshua asked.
"No," shouted Balthazar, standing up. "We will continue in my quarters."
The old wizard turned and glared at Joy and me.
"And we are not to be disturbed under any circumstances."
He took Joshua by the shoulder and led him out of the room. "So much for spying," I said. Joy consulted the chi clock and patted a cabinet filled with calligraphy materials.
"This most certainly rides on the horn of the ox. It must be moved," she pronounced.
"They are gone," I said. "We don't have to pretend at this anymore."
"Who is pretending? That cabinet channels all the yin in the hall, while the yang circles like a bird of prey."
"Joy, stop it. I know you're making this stuff up." She dropped the brass instrument to her side.
"I am not!"
"Yes, you are." And here, I thought I'd push my credibility a bit, just to see.
"I checked the yang in this room yesterday. It is in perfect balance."
Joy dropped to her hands and knees, crawled under one of the huge carved dragon tables, curled up into a ball, and began to cry.
I'm no good at this. Balthazar wants us all to know it, but I've never understood it. If you want the elegant torture of 1,000 pleasant touches, I can do it. You want someone poisoned, castrated, or blown up, I'm your man. But this feng shui stuff is just...
Stupid? I supplied.
No, I was going to say difficult. Now I've angered Balthazar, and we have no way of knowing what is happening between him and Joshua, and we must know.
I can find out, I said, polishing my nails on my tunic, but I have to know why I'm finding out.
How will you find out?
I have ways that are more subtle and crafty than all your Chinese alchemy and direction of energies.
Now who's making things up?
I'd lost most of my credibility by dragging out the arcane Hebrew knowledge for sexual favors ruse until I had actually claimed credit for receiving the tablets of the Ten Commandments as well as constructing the Ark of the Covenant. What? It's not my fault. Joshua was the one who would never let me be Moses when we were kids. If I find out, will you tell me what's going on? The head concubine chewed at an elegantly lacquered nail as she thought about it.
You promise not to tell anyone if I tell you? Not even your friend Joshua?
I promise. Then do what you will, but remember your lessons from the art of war. I considered the words of Sun Tzu, which Joy had taught me. Be extremely subtle, even to the point of formlessness. Be extremely mysterious, even to the point of soundlessness. Thereby, you can be the director of the opponent's fate. So after considering strategy carefully, running and rejecting the various scenarios in my head, working out what seemed a nearly foolproof plan, and making sure the timing was perfect, I went into action. That very night, as I lay in my bed and Joshua in his, I called forth all my powers of subtlety and mysteriousness. Hey, Josh, I said. Balthazar sodomizing you?
No.
Vice versa?
Absolutely not.
You get the feeling he'd like to? He was quiet for a second. Then he said,
He's been very attentive lately, and he giggles at everything I say. Why?
Because Joy says it's not good if he falls in love with you.
Well, it's not if he's expecting any sodomizing, I'll tell you that. That's going to be one disappointed magus.
No, worse than that. She won't tell me what, but it's really, really bad.
Biff, I realize you may not think so, but from my way of thinking, sodomizing the Son of God is really, really bad.
Good point. But I think she means something to do with whatever is behind the iron door. Until I find out, you have to keep Balthazar from falling in love with you.
I'll bet he was myrrh, said Josh.
Bastard, he brings the cheapest gift, and now he wants to sodomize me. My mother told me the myrrh went bad after a week, too. Did I mention that Joshua was not a myrrh fan?
Chapter 14.
Meanwhile, back at the hotel room, Raziel has given up his hopes to be a professional wrestler and has resumed his ambition to be Spider-Man. He made the decision after I pointed out that in Genesis, Jacob wrestles an angel and wins. In short, a human defeated an angel. Raziel kept insisting that he didn't remember that happening, and I was tempted to bring the Gideon Bible in out of the bathroom and show him the reference. But I've just started reading the Gospel of Mark, and I'd lose the book if the angel found out about it. I thought Matthew was bad, skipping right from Joshua's birth to his baptism. But Mark doesn't even bother with the birth. It's as if Joshua springs forth full-grown from the head of Zeus. Okay, bad metaphor, but you know what I mean. Mark begins with the baptism at 30. Where did these guys get these stories? I once met a guy in a bar who knew a guy whose sister's best friend was at the baptism of Joshua Bar Joseph of Nazareth, and here's the story as best he could remember it. Well, at least Mark mentions me. Once. And then it's totally out of context.
as if I was just sitting around doing nothing, and Joshua happened by and asked me to tag along. And Mark tells of the demon named Legion. Yeah, I remember Legion. Compared to what Balthazar called up, Legion was a wuss. I asked Balthazar if he was smitten with me, Joshua said over supper.
Oh, no, said Joy.
We were eating in the girls' quarters. It smelled really good, and the girls would rub our shoulders while we ate, just what we needed after a tough day of studying.
You weren't supposed to let him know we were on to him. What did he say?
He said that he'd just come off of a hard breakup and he wasn't ready for a relationship because he just needed to spend a little time getting to know himself, but that he'd love it if we could just be friends.
He lies, said Joy. He hasn't had a breakup in 100 years.
I said, Josh, you are so gullible. Guys always lie about stuff like that. That's the problem with your not being allowed to know women. It means you don't understand the most fundamental nature of men.
Which is?
We're lying pigs. We'll say anything to get what we want.
That's true, said Joy.
The other girls nodded in agreement.
But, said Josh, the superior man does not, even for the space of a single meal, act contrary to virtue, according to Confucius.
Of course, said I, but the superior man can get laid without lying. I'm talking about the rest of us.
So should I be worried about this trip he wants me to take with him?
Joy nodded gravely, and the other girls nodded with her.
I don't see why, I said. What trip?
He says we'll only be gone a couple of weeks. He wants to go to a temple at a city in the mountains. He believes that the temple was built by Solomon. It's called the Temple of the Seal.
And why do you have to go along?
He wants to show me something.
Uh-oh, I said.
Uh-oh,
echoed the girls, not unlike a Greek chorus, except, of course, they were speaking Chinese. In the week leading up to Joshua and Balthazar's departure, I managed to talk Peapods into taking on a huge risk during her shift in Balthazar's bed. I picked Peapods not because she was the most athletic and nimble of the girls, which she was, nor because she was the lightest of foot and most stealthy, which she was also, but because she was the one who had taught me to make bronze castings out of Chinese characters that were the mark of my name, my chop, and she could be trusted to get the most accurate impression of the key that Balthazar wore on the chain around his neck. Oh, yes, there was a key to the ironclad door. Joy had let it slip where Balthazar kept it, but I was sure that she was too loyal to him to steal it. Peapods, on the other hand, was more fickle in her loyalties, and lately I had been spending a lot of time with her on and off.
By the time you return, I'll know what's going on here, I whispered to Joshua as he climbed onto his camel. Find out what you can from Balthazar.
I will, but be careful. Don't do anything while I'm gone. I think this trip, whatever it is that we are going to see, has something to do with the House of Doom.
I'm just going to look around. You be careful.
The girls and I stood at the top of the plateau and waved until Joshua and the Magus, leading the extra camel loaded with supplies, rode out of sight. Then, one by one, we made our way down the rope ladder to the passageway in the cliff's face. The entrance to the passageway and the tunnel for perhaps 30 cubits were just wide enough for one man to pass through, if he stooped. And I always managed to bruise an elbow or a shoulder along the way, which allowed me to show off my ability to curse in 4 languages. By the time I got to the Chamber of the Elements, where we practiced the art of the 9 elixirs, Peapods had the small furnace stoked to a red heat and was adding ingots of brass to a small stone crucible. From the wax impression, we had made a wax duplicate of the key. From that, we made a plaster mold, which we'd fired to melt out the wax. Now we'd have one chance to cast the key, because once the metal cooled in the plaster mold, the only way to release it was to break off the plaster. When we broke off the mold, Peapods held the end of what looked like a brass dragon on a stick.
That's some key, I said.
The only locks I'd ever seen were big, bulky iron boys. Nothing elegant enough for a key like this.
When are you going to use it?
Asked Peapods. Her eyes went wide, like those of an excited child. Times like that, I almost fell in love with her. But fortunately, I was always distracted by Joy's sophistication, Pillow's maternal fussing, Number 6's dexterity, or any one of the other charms that were heaped upon me daily. I understood completely Balthazar's strategy to keep from falling in love with any one of them. Joshua's situation, on the other hand, was harder to figure, because he enjoyed spending time with the girls, trading stories from the Torah for legends of the storm dragons and the monkey king. He said that there was an innate kindness born in women that he'd never seen in a man, and he liked being around them. His strength in resisting their physical charms astounded me perhaps even more than the other miraculous things I'd seen him do over the years. I couldn't relate to the act of raising someone from the dead, but turning down a beautiful woman, that took courage beyond my understanding. "I'll take it from here," I said to Peapods. I didn't want her to be involved any further, in case things didn't turn out well.
"When?"
asked Peapods, meaning when would I attempt to open the door? "Tonight, when you have all gone to live in the world of pleasant dreams." I tweaked her nose affectionately, and she giggled. It was the last time I ever saw her in one piece. At night, the halls of the fortress were lit by the ambient light from the moon and the stars that filled in from the windows. Everywhere we went, we carried a clay oil lamp, which made the serpentine curves of the passageways seem even more like the inside of a huge creature as they swallowed up the dim orange light. After several years with Balthazar, I could find my way through the main living quarters of the fortress without any light at all, so I carried an unlit lamp with me until I had passed the girls' quarters, stopping at the beaded doorway to listen for their gentle snores. Once I was well away from the girls' door, I lit my lamp using one of the fire sticks that I'd invented, using some of the same chemicals we used to make the explosive black powder. The fire stick made a soft pop as I struck it on the stone wall, and I could swear I heard it echo from the hall up ahead. As I made my way to the ironclad door, I could smell burning brimstone, and I thought it strange that the smell of the fire stick had stayed with me. Then I saw Joy, standing by the door, holding an oil lamp and the charred remains of the fire stick she'd used to light it.
"Let me see the key," she said.
"What key?"
"Don't be foolish. I saw what was left of the mold in the room of the elements."
I took the key from where I tucked it in my belt and handed it to Joy. She examined it by lamplight, turning it this way and that.
"Peapods cast this," she said matter-of-factly. "Did she take the impression as well?"
I nodded. Joy didn't seem angry, and Peapods was the only one of the girls skilled enough in metallurgy to have done the casting, so why deny it?
"Getting the impression must have been the hard part," Joy said. "Balthazar is fierce about guarding his key. I'll have to ask her what she did to distract him. Could be a good thing to know, huh? For both of us."
She smiled seductively, then turned toward the door and pushed aside the brass plate that covered the keyhole. In that second, I felt as if a frozen dagger had been dragged over my spine.
"No!" I grabbed her hand. "Don't!"
I was overcome with a feeling of revulsion that wrenched my insides.
"We can't!"
Joy smiled again and pushed my hand away.
"I have seen many wondrous things since I came here, but there has never been anything that was harmful. You planned this. You must want to know what is in here as much as I do."
I wanted to stop her. I even tried to take the key away from her, but she grabbed my arm and pushed into a pressure point that made my whole left side go numb. She raised an eyebrow as if to ask,
"Do you really want to try that, knowing what I can do to you?"
And I stepped back. She put the dragon key into the lock and turned it three times. There was a clicking of machinery finer than anything I had ever heard. Then she withdrew the key and shot the three heavy iron bolts. As she pulled the door open, there was a rush of air, as if something had moved by us very quickly, and my lamp went out. Joshua told me what had happened later, and I put the timing together myself. As Joy and I were opening the room they called the House of Doom, Joshua and Balthazar were camped in the arid mountains of what is now Afghanistan. The night was crisp, and the stars shone with a cold blue light like loneliness or infinity. They had eaten some bread and cheese, then settled in close to the fire to share the last of a flask of fortified wine. Balthazar's second that evening.
"Have I told you of the prophecy that sent me in search of you when you were born, Joshua?"
"You spoke of the star. My mother told me of the star."
"Yes, the three of us followed that star, and by chance we met up in the mountains east of Kabul and finished the journey together. But the star wasn't the reason we went. It was only our means of navigation. We made the journey because each of us was looking for something at the end."
"Me?" Joshua said.
"Yes, but not just you, but what it is said was brought with you. In the temple where we travel now, there lies a set of clay tablets, very old. The priests say that they date back to the time of Solomon, and they foretell the coming of a child who will have power over evil and victory over death. They say he will carry the key to immortality."
"Me? Immortality?"
"Nope. I think you do. You just don't know it yet."
"Nope, I'm sure," said Joshua. "It's true that I have brought people back from the dead, but never for very long. I've gotten better at healing over the years, but my back from the dead stuff still needs work. I need to learn more."
"Which is why I have taught you, and why I am taking you to the temple now, so you may read the tablets yourself. But you must have the power of immortality within you."
"No, really, I haven't a clue."
"I am 260 years old, Joshua."
"I've heard that, but I still can't help you. You look good, though. I mean, for 260.
At this point, Balthazar started to sound desperate. "Joshua, I know that you have power over evil. Biff has told me of you banishing demons in Antioch."
"Little ones," Joshua said modestly.
"You must have power over death as well, or it does me no good."
"What I am able to do comes through my father. I didn't bargain for it."
"Joshua, I am preserved by a pact with a demon. If you do not have the powers foretold in the prophecy, I will never be free. I will never have peace. I will never have love. Every minute of my life, I must have my will focused on controlling the demon. Should my will fail, the destruction would be unlike anything the world has ever seen."
"I know how it is. I'm not allowed to know a woman," Joshua said. "Although it was an angel that told me, not a demon. But still, you know, it's hard sometimes. I really like your concubines. The other night, Pillows was giving me a back rub after a long day of studying, and I started getting this massive..."
"By the golden tenderloin of the calf!" Balthazar exclaimed, leaping to his feet, his eyes wide with terror. The old man began loading his camel, thrashing around in the darkness like a madman. Joshua was following him, trying to calm him down, fearing he might have a fit any second.
"What? What?"
"It is out," the magus said. "Help me pack up. We must go back. The demon is out."
I stood cringing in the dark, waiting for disaster to fall, for mayhem to reign, for pain and pestilence and no good to manifest. Then Joy struck a fire stick and lit our lamps. We were alone. The iron door hung open into a very small room, it too lined with iron. The entire room was just big enough to contain a small bed and a chair. Every span of the black iron walls was inlaid with golden symbols, pentagrams and hex symbols and a dozen others I had never seen before. Joy held her lamp close to the wall.
"These are symbols of containment," Joy said.
"I used to hear voices coming from in here."
"There was nothing in here when I opened the door. I could see in the second before the lamp blew out."
"Then what blew it out?"
"The wind?"
"I don't think so. I felt something brush me as it passed."
Just then, someone in the girls' quarters screamed. Then a chorus of screams joined in, primal screams of absolute terror and pain. Instantly, Joy's eyes filled with tears.
"What have I done?"
I took her sleeve and dragged her down the passage toward the girls' quarters, snatching up two heavy lances that were supporting a tapestry as we passed and handing one to her. As we rounded the curves, I could see an orange light ahead, and soon I could see that it was fire blazing on the stone walls from broken oil lamps. The screaming was reaching a higher pitch, but every few seconds a voice was removed from the chorus until there was only one. As we approached the beaded doorway into the concubine's chamber, the screaming stopped, and a severed human head rolled in front of us. The creature stepped through the curtain, oblivious to the flames that licked the walls around it, its massive body filling the passageway, the reptilian skin on its shoulders and its tall pointed ears grating against the walls and ceiling. In its talon-like hand, it held the bloody torso of one of the girls. "Hey, kid," it said, its voice like a sword point dragged across stone, a yellow light coming from behind its dinner plate-sized cat's eyes. "It took you long enough."